Do it.
Hello, everyone. This is Ashley.
And I'm Bianca.
And you're listening to Creep It Real. Thank you for listening to Creep It Real.
I don't know why every time you do that, I laugh. No matter how many times.
Well, that's the only reason I do it.
Oh.
Welcome back, everybody, and Happy New Year. Thank you to everyone who rated and reviewed us on iTunes. And I saw the one that said our FLDS episodes were bae. And yeah, I couldn't stop laughing. It was so cute.
Well, look, I guess it okay.
Oh. What?
Nothing. I was going to say, well, I guess you're laughing a lot lately. So maybe. I shouldn't take it as such a compliment.
Oh. I'm a joyful person.
Okay.
Oh, I have anxiety, but like I laugh.
I'm a joyful person.
Y'all go show us some love on iTunes and leave us a 5-star written review if you haven't already. Don't be shy. And Spotify users, go give us a follow. Everyone, feel free to share us with your friends and family.
And strangers.
And strangers.
Everywhere, man.
I always forget strangers.
Yeah, the strangers love us too.
This week, we were in between covering a cryptid or covering a UFO topic. So thank you guys so much for helping us choose. And for those who wanted a UFO, don't worry. A UFO topic is coming in the near future.
Really, this is a UFO topic.
Although after doing further research on this topic, we may have some ufology interspersed all up in here.
It's essentially, it's half UFO, half cryptid. It's a hybrid of both. So everybody got what they wanted.
Anyway, we're so excited to start 2021 with another big topic, one that we all know and love and hold dearly to our hearts, Mothman. For our research, we read the 1975 classic, The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel, and various other sources will be listed in the show notes.
Yeah, go look there if you want some information. Okay. Once upon a time, a cold, rainy night late in November 1967, at the witching hour at 3 a.m., a stranger walked up to the door of a decrepit old farmhouse in the hills of West Virginia and pounded on the door. Being a rural area, strangers were uncommon, especially at 3 a.m. When the young woman who lived at the home answered the door, she found a man, well over 6 foot tall, dressed entirely in black. He had a black suit, tie, hat, overcoat, black dress shoes covered in mud. Although it was dark and his face was barely visible, what she could see was that he had a trimmed goatee and a mustache. "May I use your phone?" the man asked in a deep baritone that I can't do, without the typical West Virginia accent that they were accustomed to. The woman shut the door, afraid, and went to get her husband. Once he came to the door, he barely got it open an inch before getting a look at the man and telling him they didn't have a phone and slammed the door in the mysterious stranger's face. The couple told all their friends about the strange man that had shown up at their door in the middle of the night, eventually coming to the conclusion that it was obviously an omen of sorts. Maybe that had even been the goddamn devil himself. 3 weeks later, the couple was driving over the Silver Bridge stretching over the Ohio River in Point Pleasant when it suddenly collapsed in the greatest tragedy to occur in that area of West Virginia. The couple died, and their friends remembered the omen they spoke about in the weeks leading up to the bridge collapse. Perhaps it had been that pesky old devil.
And so the legend that Beelzebub visited West Virginia on the eve of a horrendous tragedy was born. Gray Barker, who you will remember from our Project Blue Book and Men and Women in Black episodes, initially introduced the general population to the notion of Mothman, and John Keel, the author of the Mothman Prophecies, further popularized him with his book. In West Virginia folklore, the Mothman is a cryptid who was reportedly seen in the Point Pleasant area from November 15th of 1966 to December 15th of 1967. The first newspaper report was published in the Point Pleasant Register, dated November 16, 1966, titled, "Couples See Man-Sized Bird Creature Something."
What a headline.
The national press soon picked up the reports and helped spread the story across the United States. Already for the first sighting in 1966, witnesses and media used the name Mothman in variations, aside many other expressions. Most of them suggested an avian appearance like man-sized bird, birdman, bird-like creature, or bird monster,
Should have stuck with bird monster, because that would have really...
Damn it, that would have been so much better.
Struck fear in the hearts of everyone.
Mothman prevailed in later publications is the only term used, and is essentially explained by the role model effect of Batman and his criminal counterpart, Killer Moth.
Counterpart. So, diffusionism is the way to attempt to understand the spread of cultural traits from one society to another. Versions of diffusionism include the belief that all culture derived from one cultural center, another less extreme belief that cultures were born from a limited number of culture centers, I can't talk, and lastly, the notion that each society is influenced by others, but that the process of diffusion is both contingent and arbitrary. However, scientists wanted to separate themselves from the people who ascribed to this belief because many of them were UFO heads that were a little bit loony, and they chose another explanation that many inventions and ideas simply occurred simultaneously to isolated cultures spread around the world. And there are archaeological sites in the Mississippi Valley that are dated well over 8,000 years ago, far earlier than Native Americans were supposed to have arrived. They are burial mounds that are laid out and constructed similarly to the Egyptian pyramids as far as mathematical precision is concerned. And while some mounds were still being added at the time of the Europeans' virus-ridden arrival, many were considerably older. What's more, some are built in the form of elephants, while others are in the shape of sea serpents. The forms are so large that they can only be seen from the air. So what do these natives use as a model for these giant mountains of artistically shaped earth? What did they use to plan and build them? They were supposedly simple nomadic woods tribes, and somehow they're using mathematical precision to create burial mounds that you can only see from the sky. I find that to be hard to believe. We know that cave paintings seemingly depict what we know as UFOs, and terrifying creatures and paranormal entities have been spoken of since the beginning of time in pretty much every culture known to man. Folklore of many cultures, nearly all of them in fact, include stories of giant winged creatures. In India, they have the giant birds known as Garuda, which are an important part of their mythology as the gods Vishnu and Krishna traveled through the heavens on the back of the Garuda. Mexico has Ikals. They are tiny black men endowed with the power of flight who live in caves and kidnap humans. Indigenous Americans have extensive legends about the Thunderbird, and the stories are common in the Bridgewater Triangle, especially, as we talked about in episode 75, and this is kind of that same general area.
So this takes place in West Virginia, and the area of West Virginia is located entirely within the Appalachian region. The state is almost entirely mountainous, giving reason to the nickname the Mountain State and the motto Montani Semper Liberi, meaning mountaineers are always free.
Is this my song, too?
It is your song.
West Virginia, mountain highway.
Mountain mama.
Mountain mama. See? See? I'm the worst. It's not my song.
It's not your song.
It's not my song, anyway. It doesn't make any sense, but go on. Go on.
Mountain highway. The elevations and ruggedness drop near large rivers like the Ohio River or the Shenandoah River. About 75% of the state is within the Cumberland Plateau and Allegheny Plateau regions. I hope I'm saying all of these things right, so sorry.
Plateau?
Yep. No, the word and. The underlying rock strata are sandstone, shale, bituminous coal beds, and limestone laid down in a near-shore environment from sediments derived from mountains to the east in a shallow inland sea on the west. Some beds illustrate a coastal swamp environment, some river delta, some shallow water. The Appalachian Mountains are some of the oldest on Earth, having formed more than 300 million years ago.
And in those mountains, people brush their teeth with Mountain Dew.
Yes, they do. In those mounds. Natives to the United States initially avoided West Virginia. The story goes that natives to the United States avoided West Virginia. Before Europeans arrived, the nations had spread out and divided up the North American continent.
I was going to ask because I did read that some native West Virginians do take umbrage to the fact that they've been written out of history.
That's why I say the story goes.
So I do, but then I was like, but so is that accurate that it was uninhabited? You know, anyway.
Right. Modern anthropologists have worked out maps of native occupants of pre-Columbian America according to the languages spoken. The Shawnee and Cherokee occupied the areas to the south and southwest, and the Shawnee also occupied some of the areas of West Virginia after doing some more research on the area. The Monacans settled to the east, and Erie and Conestoga claimed the areas north of West Virginia. Even the inhospitable deserts of the far west were divided and occupied, and there was only one spot of the map labeled uninhabited, that being West Virginia.
Mountain Mama.
Oh, all of a sudden we know the lyrics.
Yep.
Although rich with fertile land, game, and heavily wooded area, natives were very clearly avoiding the area, creating an uncomfortable vacuum. There are strange ruins in the state, like Ashley just said, consisting of circular stone monuments, which prove someone had settled the region once. But let me be clear, there were natives that were inhabiting the land. It's just unclear which nation of how many people, where, when, and for how long lived in and settled West Virginia. The Native American presence in the state lingers, and Native American names can be found throughout Appalachia, like the Kanawha River, Seneca Rocks, and Wheeling, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure Shenandoah has something to do with Native language as well.
Yeah, I bet it does. So basically, unless I'm getting ahead here, what's new would be that they were insinuating, I guess, in some of the books that no one settled in West Virginia for some unknown reason, even though it's this fertile, amazing land that you should be populating like crazy. But you're like, we're going to step this one out.
Right.
For some mysterious reason.
Right. Okay. That's the insinuation.
Yeah.
The truth might not be that.
Yeah.
Probably isn't that. On October 10th of 1774, the Battle of Point Pleasant was fought at the confluence of the Ohio and Kanawha Rivers. The Native American warriors were led by Shawnee chief Keetukwa, known to the Virginians as Cornstalk. Chief Cornstalk was renowned as a great warrior and gained the respect and admiration of the white men during the battle. Admiration, I mean, who knows,
really? Yeah.
They regarded the Shawnee chief as a formidable opponent and an exceptional military commander. However, the Virginians had the advantage of firepower. The Native Americans' arrows and tomahawks were no match for muskets, and after suffering heavy losses, Chief Cornstalk called for a retreat. At the site of the battle, Fort Randolph was built as a barrier to a possible retaliation by the Native Americans, who probably wanted and would have reclaimed the land the Virginians had taken from them. It was there, years later, that the curse of Point Pleasant was born. In November of 1777, battles began again, and Chief Cornstalk came to the front to negotiate a peace treaty in an effort to avoid more bloodshed. He was immediately taken into custody along with Red Hawk, who was a Delaware chief, and an unknown third Native American. Later, Chief Cornstalk's son arrived, and he was also taken into custody. On November 8th, all four of the prisoners were shot and killed. But before he died, it is believed that Chief Cornstalk called on the Great Spirit to curse the land for 200 years in retaliation for the wrongful death of his son and friends.
And I'm not saying that Chief Cornstalk shouldn't have cursed these people, but is it just an old white man claiming that the native was, you know, is because this very well could be a old racist trope, rhetoric. Essentially.
Yeah.
So just, you know, just like with the demon worshiping with voodoo, hoodoo, whatever, you know, stuff like that. So it, like you were saying, there's a reason why you said there's stories.
The story goes.
But, you know, there's also, it's worth mentioning that it could just be birthed from racism.
Right. Right. According to Benjamin Smith Barton's New Views of the Origins of the Tribes and Nations of America, which was written in 1798, so
very modern.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Exactly. The Cherokee have a tale that when they migrated to Tennessee, they found the region inhabited by a strange race of white people who lived in houses and were quite civilized. But their eyes were very large and sensitive to light, only being able to see at night. According to the book that we read, The Mothman Prophecies, the Cherokee ran these moon-eyed people out, begging the question, did they move to West Virginia to escape? The remain remorse
Trying to make it a little fancier than it needs to be.
There remain rumors that there is an oddball group of albino people in the back hills of Kentucky and Tennessee, which there probably are.
There definitely are, 100%. 150%, in fact.
But there are also myths and rumors of mysterious people living in the hills of New Jersey, 40 miles from Manhattan.
True. I think in the hills of anywhere, there's going to be some strange folks, okay? There's some moon-eyed people in every hill in America.
Moon-eyed. During World War II, high explosives were manufactured in Point Pleasant. 7 miles outside of town, part of a wildlife station and bird sanctuary, McClintock Wildlife Station was partly ripped up. Miles of underground tunnels were digged, linking camouflage buildings and factories. 100 igloos, which were huge concrete domes with heavy steel doors, were where the finished explosives were safely stored. And these were scattered across the fields and woods, and dirt and grass covered the domes, so from the air, the whole area had a somewhat harmless appearance. After the war, most of the explosives were carted away, the factories were dismantled, and the entrances and exits of the tunnels were plugged with thick concrete slabs. And that wood and dirt and grass that covered the domes from the air kind of also went away, like with environmental changes. So then you could now see the domes from the air.
Yeah. And people would go and hang out there.
Yes.
And then we'll talk about it a little bit more in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So while I know that we have already covered the Men in Black, the fact of the matter is that they are so intrinsically linked to so many other paranormal phenomena that in discussing Mothman, we're going to have to dip our toesies back into the Men in Black pool a little bit. I would say maybe a lot. There's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
While chimera or cryptids come in all shapes and sizes, from a talking mongoose in the wall to a 9-foot hairy tall beast, few make an appearance in almost every single country on Earth other than the Men in Black. In the old days, he was regarded as the devil incarnate, dressing in black and riding a black horse. As time went on, he would arrive in a black horse-drawn carriage, then even hearses. Now it seems that the man steps out of an unidentified flying object most of the time in remote rural locations, and sometimes in just a good old black Cadillac. In all these stories, the descriptions are similar. The man is built like a human. He's tall, slight, has high cheekbones, unusually long fingers, an olive or reddish complexion. He can speak every language. Often it seems like it's robotic or memorized. He has trouble breathing, often gasping between words, and the footprints that he leaves behind him seem to stop suddenly as if he vanished into thin air.
On April 22, 1897, an oblong machine with wings and lights and which appeared much brighter than electric lights, dropped out of the sky and landed on a farm near Rockland, Texas, owned by John M. Barclay. He grabbed his rifle and headed for the machine.
Being a good old Texan, Barclay grabbed his rifle and headed out to investigate because obviously shoot first and ask questions later.
He was met by an ordinary-looking man who handed him a $10 bill and asked him to buy some oil and tools for the machine. When he asked the person who they were, the man answered, "Never mind about my name. Call it Smith."
Well, don't even say never mind about my name,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, just say Smith.
Idiot.
What's wrong with you?
You really took the gas out of your sails there.
UFO lore is populated with mysterious visitors claiming inordinately common names like Smith, Jones, Kelly, Allen, and Brown. So maybe that was...
It goes right along with it. Back in 1897, the strangers often said that they were from nearby cities and towns and could name prominent people in them. But when reporters investigated, the people said that they had no knowledge of them and they could find no record of their existence.
A proven hoax of 1897 concerned an object which is supposed to have crashed into Judge Proctor's windmill in Aurora, Texas. I say proven hoax because there were many proven hoaxes and they were really the work of mischievous newspapermen trying to sell papers.
What the fuck?
I know.
That's out of this world.
Completely crazy. I can't believe them. This hoax stated that the remains of a tiny pilot were supposedly found in the wreckage and buried in the local cemetery by the townspeople. The story was actually published in the Dallas Evening News, and from time to time, Aurora was visited by investigators who sifted the dirt on the old Proctor farm and marched through the cemetery reading tombstones, always without finding anything.
Sifted the dirt?
That seems a little much.
take it down a couple notches, please. In the 1920s, Charles Fort, the first writer to explore the unexplainable, observed that paranormal phenomena was so widespread and diverse, while being so sporadic yet persistent, that he believed he could not use enough adjectives to describe it. That he believed studying any single element was not only a waste of time, but would also automatically lead to the development of belief. He said once a belief is established, the phenomenon adjusts its manifestation to support the belief, which inevitably escalates it. And if you subscribe to such a thing, you can see how that would be possible. Okay. So if you
it's like a tulpa.
Yes, exactly. If you believe in the devil, he'll come sauntering to your door. If you believe in demons and withhold mental health care for your daughter, then she's possibly possessed by evil entities. It kind of just begets itself. In the summer of 1967, at a famous watering hole in New York, Max's Kansas City, a strange fella walked into the restaurant, which we should add was already known for strange clientele. But the waitress was like, this guy is awfully strange. The man was described as tall and awkward, dressed in an out-of-style and ill-fitting suit. His chin was incredibly pointy, and he had eyes that bulged slightly from his face. He had very long tapering fingers he used to gesture for the waitress. Something to eat, the man mumbled to her. She handed him a menu at which he looked incredulously. Food, he almost pleaded. She offered him a steak, and when she brought it out, it was clear the man was completely confused about how to use the utensils. So she showed him how to use his knife and fork, and he sawed away, stuffing his face, clearly starving. Where are you from? She asked. Not from here, he said. Where? He answered, another world. And so began that story.
Huh.
Yeah. In another story, following a slew of UFO sightings in the area, a Mrs. Butler from Owatonna, Minnesota, was visited by a man, and I know I butchered that name because every name I say at work, they're like, oh, listen to the way Ashley says, Minnetonka, but that one I said right.
I used to say Adina.
Oh, it's a Dina. And you can only live there if you want to spend $1 million on a house.
Have you seen those TikToks?
No.
That are like, good morning to everybody in Minnesota, except for those in Edina.
No.
No. Pretentious fucks.
I just know their houses are nice over there. And if they're not, they still think they are.
Anyways.
Okay. Was visited by a man who said he was Major Richard French of the U.S. Air Force, but was wearing civilian clothes and driving a white Ford Mustang. He was dressed in a sharp gray suit, and everything on him appeared to be brand new down to the soles of his shoes. He stood about 5'9", with an olive complexion, pointed face, dark, very long hair. She thought it was far too long for a military officer. Mm. She said he was a fluent conversationalist, and everything seemed very normal until he complained of his stomach bothering him. For some reason that is perhaps explained by the times, she offered him Jell-O, and that was when she began to realize something was not quite right. I mean, I'm like, if someone's like, oh man, I'm so hungry, like the last thing I'm going to give you is
Jell-O.
Is, yeah, gelatin mixed with food coloring and some sugar. What are you, a child? She gave him the bowl of Jell-O, and Air Force Officer Richard French picked the bowl up and tried to drink it. And apparently it was like an individual serving size. So sure. She thought it was kind of weird. She had no idea why he didn't know how to eat Jell-O. And I was like, the whole time I'm just thinking, this story is just so not applicable right now, because it's like, yeah, maybe no one does know how to eat Jell-O because it's stupid. It's pointless. Just leave it alone. But she showed him how to eat the useless substance with a spoon. This Mr. French was one of many mysterious figures that traveled the United States at this time, going from town to town, attempting to silence witnesses of UFOs and UFO enthusiasts, convincing them that they were under investigation by the government, silencing witnesses, and allegedly even getting to the point of committing murder. While your first inclination is probably and should be skepticism regarding the accounts of these mystery men, as with many topics we cover on Creep It Real, there are details that just continue to be present in each and every story, and over time, with enough accounts, you simply must open your mind to the possibility that there is something legitimate behind these cases. I've said it before, and I'll say it again, but these people are all seamlessly planning and pulling off a giant caper together in the times before the internet, corroborating on details that had never been published or publicly discussed. So there's got to be something to the fact that there's these similar characteristics in everything. In almost every single case, the men, and sometimes women, all made some small error in dress or behavior that drew attention to the fact that something was just off about them. They typically arrived in older model cars that were kept up impeccably to the point that they looked brand new, even the interior and the leather and whatnot. They often missed the mark with the way they dressed, either being incredibly out of style, and in some cases wearing clothes that wouldn't come into style for a number of years later.
Interesting. I've never heard that.
I thought it was interesting too. Lastly, these men and women all matched descriptions given by people who had claimed to see a UFO land and had seen or even spoken to their pilots. They either had very pointed features and olive complexions, and all of them had unusually long fingers, which is like one of the biggest things everybody seemed to notice about them. Which, I mean, that is probably creepy.
Long fingers.
Long, pointy fingers. And on top of it, they're already kind of like weird complexions.
I mean, they could be piano players.
So they're just traveling.
Pianists have long ass fingers.
Why are they so interested in UFO witnesses then? Piano enthusiasts.
Aficionados.
Out there. Are you a man in black? Or are you? Okay. We're done. Okay, we're done. So Mothman sightings or creatures similar to Mothman that you would maybe think are possibly the same description have been seen all over the United States. It's not just in Point Pleasant, but that is the probably most famous place that they were seen. In Brooklyn, New York, in 1877 to 1880, there was a winged man in black that haunted the city. He would fly above sunbathers on Coney Island, performing aerial acrobatics, and doing so in broad daylight. It was clearly a man with wings, not simply a bird. According to the New York Times, on September 18, 1877, the creature was seen by many reputable persons engaged in flying toward New Jersey at an altitude of 1,000 feet and making swimming-like movements, his black form standing out sharply against the clear blue sky. What in the world? That is the weirdest thing, and very kind of creepy when you start to think about it.
Swimming-like movements?
Yeah, so a man with wings doing aerial acrobatics in the sky for people that were just laying out at the beach, and then traveling towards New Jersey, swimming through the air. I don't know. It just, the more I thought about it, the creepier it started to get to me. Like, what is this? That doesn't even make sense in a string theory kind of way. Like in a overlapping dimension type of thing. Like, what is happening here? Anyway, okay, so moving on. In Louisville, Kentucky in 1880, that winged man was busy there as well, at least according to the Courier Journal. Two men, C.A. Youngman and Bob Flexner, reported seeing, quote, a man surrounded by machinery, which he seemed to be working with his hands. He had wings or fans on his back, which he was flapping rather desperately to keep aloft. The frightened men watched him fly out of view, but it wouldn't be the last time they saw him, which is crazy.
That's interesting, because why is he flapping rather desperately to keep aloft?
Well, okay.
While the other one was swimming.
Yeah. Yes.
There.
Yeah. Similarly, astronomers have reported seeing these creatures as well. On November 30th, 1880, an Italian astronomer named Rico, I'm sure, I don't know,
Rico
was studying the sun on the observatory in Palermo, Sicily, around 8 a.m. when he saw winged bodies in two long parallel lines traveling slowly across the disk of the sun. In Popular Astronomy in 1912, a Dr. F.B. Harris stated that the evening of January 27th, 1912, he saw an intensely black object like a crow flying in front of the moon. He estimated it at 250 miles long by 50 miles wide. And I was like, wait a second.
Did you see a cloud?
What do you mean exactly?
What the fuck?
I don't know. I don't really. That was such a large size that I don't
That's
even
a very
understand
large size.
How you could even
it's like a ship in there.
Estimate.
Jesus.
I mean, it would be
250 miles.
Miles. That's more than a ship. I'm like, you couldn't ever have. I don't. That's what it said, though. Anyway,
and just wait, 200. How do you even
I don't
estimate
know.
That?
I have no idea. Either way, just take it at this.
Okay,
that it must have been freaking enormous. Okay,
yeah,
it was bigger than any crow that you could ever imagine in your life. In 1905, a quote Titanic white bird flew around California. One witness, a J.A. Jackson, said he saw a brilliant light in the sky, which seemed to be attached to a 70-foot airship with wings. Quote, "The mysterious machine appeared to be propelled by the wings alone and rose and fell as the wings flapped like a gigantic bird." The Brawley, California News reported August 4th, 1905. Others in the area reported seeing the very same thing somehow. I don't understand what these things are. These are just some very...
An airship.
It's like a, it's a ship in the air with literal wings. So.
You think that's why they called it an airship?
Because it was a ship in the air.
Did I say the ship? Well, it's in the air. It's a ship in the air with wings, with actual
wings.
Functional wings, which doesn't make any sense.
You know what, though? What? Sorry. No, I'm go ahead, like, go. Gonna, I'm like, maybe it's just, okay, so the way that they're describing something is akin to what they know they at know. The time.
Yeah.
So, for instance, like, we know what a car is. They're not going to know what a car is in 1877. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we know what an airplane is. Mm-hmm. They're not going to know what that is and whatever.
That's true.
So maybe it doesn't look like, because in my mind, what it looks like is a ship, an actual ship, mm-hmm. like a wooden or like Viking ship in the air with like oars and shit. That's what it looks like to me in my mind. But maybe they're just describing things.
I just don't know why they would think it was flapping its wings, even if it had wings.
True.
I don't know. I mean, you are right, but I don't know why things would be flapping.
Right. That's true.
Because that's not
no
ergonomic.
Interesting.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Keep going. Sorry.
On July 11th, 1908, the famous
once an episode.
The famous Russian traveler V.K. Arsenov was trekking along the Gobili River when he had this encounter. He said, "I saw the mark on the path that was very similar to a man's footprint. My dog Alpha bristled up, snarled, and then something rushed about nearby, trampling among the bushes. However, it didn't go away, but stopped nearby, standing stock still. We had been standing like that for some minutes. Then I stooped, picked up a stone, and threw it towards the unknown animal. Then something happened that was quite unexpected. I heard the beating of wings. Something large and dark emerged from the fog and flew over the river. A moment later, it disappeared into the dense mist. My dog, badly frightened, pressed itself to my feet. After supper, I told the Udehi men about this incident. They broke into a vivid story about a man who could fly in the air. Hunters often saw his tracks that appeared suddenly and vanished suddenly in such a way that they could only be possible if the quote-unquote man alighted on the ground and then took off again into the air. One night in October 1946, a group of 16 people were gathered on a rooftop to watch a meteor shower when a bluish white-winged object appeared in the sky, looking like an extremely long airplane with two reddish lights. The whole thing left a luminous contrail. One of the witnesses told journalist Harold T. Wilkins, who we talked about in our Men in Black episode, the strange object was certainly no airplane. The wings, which moved, were too wide for any bird. Indeed, they were rather like the wings of a butterfly. The whole object emitted a red glow. Some of the witnesses said it resembled a giant bat, which is truly mind-boggling. The whole thing is mind-boggling. From May to August of 1947, the U.S. saw its first major UFO wave. They saw reddish flying cigars, glowing discs in the sky, bright, odd lights all became a fascination for the whole country. The government, obviously set on covering up the facts, attempted to disseminate misinformation, and conspiracy theorists emerged from the woodworks, quickly chalking the sightings up to creatures from outer space. And soon enough, it was an afterthought. And so the next year, when a spate of giant winged creatures began to be spotted around the place, pretty much no one gave it any thought because it was just kind of going along with all that craziness.
Conspiracy shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the beginning of January, a farmer from Chehalis, Washington reported seeing a sizzing and whizzing man.
Sizzing and whizzing.
That sounds like something I would say. You're just,
you're just
absolutely making words up because they rhyme together. With silver wings maneuvering around 200 feet above her barn. And 4 months later, two laundry workers in Longview, Washington, which is about 40 miles south of Chehalis, said that they saw three birdmen circling the city at around 250 feet.
You know what? I'm just thinking, like, fucking birdmen. It's UFOs. They're seeing UFOs. This sounds like UFOs to me. I don't know.
I guess.
But it's a man with, like, I don't even know what to think about it.
Okay.
So they said, when they first came into sight, I thought they looked like gulls, but as they got closer, I could make out that they weren't gulls, and I knew they were men. I could see plainly that they were men. They wore dark, drab flying suits. I couldn't make out their arms, but I could see their legs dangling down, and they kept moving their heads like they were looking around. I couldn't tell if they had goggles on, but their heads looked like they had helmets on. I couldn't see their faces.
That's a similar situation with a lot of Mothman situations.
Yes, yes, yes. But the silver wing thing.
I mean, that does sound like a... But you're sitting here telling me it's a bird. Like, you can't...
But it looks like a bird, but they're like... Silver.
They had arms hanging down and legs hanging down.
Right.
Tons of other sightings happened that year all over the country in focused areas at a time. Even my home state was not excluded from these winged man sightings, as three people in Houston, Texas, saw the figure of a man with wings like a bat, dressed in tight-fitting black clothes and surrounded by an eerie glow in June of 1953. I could see him plain, and I could see he had big wings folded at his shoulders, Mrs. Hilda Walker said. They said he was about 6'6" and perched on a limb of a pecan tree. And as, I know, isn't that
cute? I love the way that you said pecan.
Oh.
I thought you were going to say pecan.
No.
I'm just surprised that you didn't say pecan.
That's not how we say it in Texas.
Well, I don't think you should say pecan like that anywhere.
Why?
Because it's
pecan?
Pecan. It's not pecan.
Right. You shouldn't say pecan. Yeah, I thought you were saying you shouldn't that's say pecan. And I was like, excuse
no,
me, that's
it's
the normal
adorable.
Way.
It's beautiful. Pecan. Anyways, sorry, you can cut that whole thing. I just think it's so pretty. Anyways, keep going.
So he was perched on the limb of a pecan tree. And as he did perch there, his glow began to diminish and suddenly he just disappeared. Immediately afterward, Miss Walker continued, we heard a loud swoosh over the housetops across the street. It was like the white flash of a torpedo-shaped object. Another witness, Howard Phillips, agreed with her description completely. So it was almost as if it was immediately transported into a
dimension.
A UFO of some sort.
Torpedo-shaped object.
Yeah, the white flash of a unless the bird itself turned
it's so
into a
fast,
torpedo.
Or is so fast that it just looks like a torpedo-shaped object because the human eye can't see.
Then, in 1961, these flying creatures made a resurgence. One woman in Florida described a, quote, big vulture with a wingspread of about 55 feet, which I think maybe a little bigger than a vulture, even a big one. In May, a pilot cruising over the Hudson River Valley said he thought he was crazy for a moment because a bird much larger than an eagle, which he described as more like a prehistoric pterodactyl, swooped at his plane. Across the country in the Ohio River Valley, a prominent woman from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, was driving on Route 2 with her elderly father, and as they passed through a portion on the edge of a park known as Chief Cornstalk Hunting Grounds, a tall man-like figure appeared in the road before them. She slowed down, and as they got closer, they realized the large gray figure was much larger than a man. It stood in the middle of the road, and then a pair of wings unfolded from its back and practically filled up the entire road. They said it took off straight up into the air, disappearing in a matter of seconds. They were terrified and raced away as quickly as possible. They discussed it and decided not to tell anyone. Jacques Vallée, French statistician and computer expert, was given access to the Air Force's UFO files, and he found a curious report from an Air Force colonel who was driving along an Illinois road one evening when he became aware of something flying above his car. He said that it was a huge bird the size of a small airplane, and it flapped its wings and soared away. So there's a lot of these fucking giant birds, and a lot of people who you would think you could trust. that aren't going to just mistake a flying giant bird man with a plane.
Yeah. I just don't know what you could mistake it with.
Or even like a glider. Right. You know, a glider isn't like getting that close to the ground.
No.
And not flapping its wings
right.
wildly.
Right, right, right. But this didn't just happen in the United States.
Oh.
I know. So let's dig into the story of John Flaxton from Kent, England.
Hello, governor.
I'm sorry to all of our British listeners.
Oi.
I apologize one more time. You know who you sound like? And this is going to come off as an insult, but it's not. My mom. My mom does that all the time. But it's because I used to do that all the time just to make fun of the accent. Anyways.
Okay.
On a cold night in November of 1963, John, who was 17 at the time, and his friend Mervyn Hutchinson and two other teen boys were walking home from a party on Sandling Road. As the group walked down the road, they were entranced by a brilliant ball of light hovering over a field near Sandling Park in Maidstone. The light made no sound. I mean, I don't know why that's necessary to say. Of course.
Why would it make a sound? I guess because if it's a flying object of some sort, you would think it would be making some sort of sound. I don't know.
But glowed with an intensity that was brighter than any plane they had ever seen. They watched the ball of light move silently and it descended into a thick...
What? You really want to keep talking about how silent it is, right?
Yeah.
That silent light. that suspicious silent light over there.
The soundless light. They watched the ball of light move silently and... Fuck, I can't not laugh when I say it. Anyways, the ball of light descended into a thick grove of trees near the park. There are a couple differing stories regarding what happened. One says that the group felt an overwhelming sense of fear and ran away. And one says that curiosity got the better of them and they ventured across the field and stood just outside the tree line.
That's two different
hugely different okay. stories. However, whatever the case may be, the story does end the same. Whatever the orb was, it appeared to have been extinguished. They were about to leave whatever area they were in when something emerged from the foliage and it was a creature that completely terrified the young men. According to John and Mervyn, it waddled out of the woods.
Wait.
And no.
A second.
It's described the same in each story. So the waddling.
A terrifying waddle. It must have just been the scariest fucking... Because you doing this waddling motion right now is like, oh, it's like, oh, that thing would have been a precious little baby that I needed to scoop up into my arms.
I know.
Yeah, a little baby.
It's like a penguin and stood about 10 feet from them.
Oh, the moth penguin. With wings.
Adorable.
So cute. Somebody. Draw this for me.
Are you saying that because you're jealous that Pia drew the Mothman for the Bumbles?
Well, it just happened to be the week we were going to cover Mothman, too. Right? I was like, it's okay.
I cried, too. No worries. Anyways, the creature was described as having a thick, hairy body, large webbed feet, and giant membranous wings similar to a bat's. But the weirdest thing about the creature was that it had nothing that resembled a head. When the creature spread its giant wings and flapped them, the four boys knew it was time to go. They screamed and fled whatever the thing was and didn't stop running until they reached the local police station to report the light and the creature that must have come from it. The police listened to their story and could tell by the tone of their voices and the look of terror upon their faces that they had seen something that truly frightened them. Nevertheless, their skeptical nature took over and they did their best to convince the boys that they probably saw an owl.
It was just an owl,
well,
boys.
Well, you know, those bat-winged owls that are so common in England.
You know, they just are the size of humans and they waddle out of the forest and they're very scary.
And they have... bat wings. That's like the main thing.
That's a pigeon.
Yeah, that is.
That's an owl.
That is. Thank you.
Moo. That's a cow. That's a dog. Just gonna. I'll
we're gonna go through all the animals.
I'm done. Okay, animals. We're done. We're done with the animals.
Well, anyways, a lack of light and shadows could play tricks on the eyes, according to the police, and make people think that they saw something unexplained.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the logical stance of the police fell apart when they began receiving reports from others that were eerily similar to what the teams claimed to have encountered.
Oh.
The days following the report made by John and Mervyn and their companions were filled with reports of something strange in Sandling Park. More strange lights were seen in Sandling Woods, and investigators found three giant footprints, an inch deep, 2 feet long.
2 feet long.
And 9 inches across.
9 inches across.
That feels very
two
big.
2 feet long. That's like 3 feet long. That's a full-on yard. There you go. That's a big-ass foot right there.
That's huge.
It sounds like a squatch, if you ask me.
3 weeks later, a group of people, including two newspaper reporters, visited the site and found the whole forest illuminated by a strange pulsating light, and they watched it from a distance for half an hour, though they were too afraid to go in any closer, which I would be too.
Yeah. I mean, you could get sucked into a vortex.
Yes.
Who knows?
Who knows what the fuck that is?
All I know is that's a big old foot. What does that mean exactly?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what they say about big feet.
Yeah, are you packing, Mothman? You may not be as scary as I thought. See?
See, what are you?
I was trying to be like
a floozy from 1946.
Yeah. I gotta remember Betty Boop.
Oh my
boop,
god.
Boop, biddy, doop, boop.
No. That's Betty Boop.
It's boop boop biddy, boop. You were making the call of the UFO that we're gonna talk about in a minute, is what you were just doing. You're like boop boop beep boop boop boop. In Arlington, Virginia, in the winter of 1968 and 1969, a businessman and three of his friends were at a farm when they heard a strange rushing sound near a small lake. They set out with flashlights and a couple dogs, and suddenly the dogs howled, turned, and ran away. The men found a huge dark shadow between 8 and 12 feet tall with large red-orange eyeballs and wing-like arms. Whoa.
Ugh.
12 feet tall? I mean,
that's Ash's boyfriend.
12 feet tall? That could have a 2 foot by God. Nine.
That's true. Yeah.
Footprint. That might go together there. In Vietnam in the summer of 1969, Marine Corps Private First Class Earl Morrison and two of his buddies were sitting on top of a bunker near Da Nang.
Da Nang.
I'm sorry, everyone. Why don't I know anything? On a toasty summer evening, when all of a sudden in the sky, they saw a figure coming toward them that had a glow to it, and they were unable to make it out at first. They said it had wings that looked like bat wings, but were much, much larger. Once it got closer, they realized it looked like a naked woman, and her body, skin, wings, everything was very dark black, but it glowed with a greenish cast, and that it appeared as though she gave off a radiance. Her arms looked like regular arms with hands and fingers, but there was skin going from them to the wings, and they could only hear the flapping of those wings once she got close overhead. They said she flew overhead within 7 feet, and then just flew off and disappeared. The whole encounter took place within a span of 3 to 4 minutes. So, Leonardo da Vinci studied the flight of birds and attempted numerous times to build a man-powered ornithopter without success. Thousands of others have tried since and have been unsuccessful. In May of 1962, a man named John C. Wimpany did manage to fly 993 yards at an altitude of 5 feet, which is like really not very high, in a contraption he created with rigid wings and a pedal-driven propeller in England.
I mean, to be fair,
mm-hmm.
That's kind of a tongue twister.
Oh, pedal-driven propeller?
Yes.
Aerodynamically speaking, Mothman, with its helicopter-like takeoff, is not really very possible. Large birds take off by running along the ground, flapping their wings to gain enough momentum, and then they take off. But all the stories that we have heard so far and that we're going to hear, none of them have Mothman going, I need a runway, and running around in a circle until he gets enough
and he just,
moment.
Like, okay. Kind of like he squats just and like
flies off into the air.
Right.
Mary Heyer was a reporter for the Athens Messenger in Point Pleasant and the go-to person in town for any information about it and its residents. Her niece, 18-year-old Connie Carpenter, had an experience in 1966 she came to John Keel with right away. He would later say he knew she was telling the truth because her eyes were watery, red, and almost swollen shut, which were symptoms of UFO reports that he had seen many times. And we have mentioned on previous UFO-related episodes, people who encounter UFOs in all their variations up close, which are typically accompanied by an incredibly bright aerial light and are exposed to actinic and ultraviolet rays, which cause an effect called, quote, eye burn, which is medically known as Klieg conjunctivitis. It's the same rays that give you a sunburn and conjunctivitis when you don't protect your eyeballs at the beach or something like that. Eyeballs. But we may not officially know what UFOs actually are, but we do know that they radiate intense actinic rays, and there are thousands upon thousands of cases where the witnesses suffered these burns, temporary eye damage, and in some cases, temporary blindness. An extreme example of this came in October of 1973 in Greenville, Missouri, when 45-year-old Eddie Webb, who saw a luminous object in his rearview mirror, then stuck his head out of the window and immediately said that there was a bright white flash. He threw his hands to his face, crying out, "Oh my God, I'm burned. I can't see." His wire-framed glasses were melted, and one of the lenses had fallen from them. His wife immediately took over driving and went immediately to the hospital, where he would go on to recover and get his sight back.
Oh, thank goodness.
So the damage was only temporary. But, I mean, what in the world is that powerful that it's going to melt your glasses when it's not on top of you?
Right.
It's just crazy. In March of 1966, a woman going by the name Miss Kelly was waiting in her car for her children near the Point Pleasant School when she saw a glistening metal disc hovering directly above the playground. A door-like aperture was open at the disc's rim, and there was a man standing outside of it in midair. She said that he wore a silvery skin-tight costume, had long silvery hair, and was looking down to the schoolyard intently. She said she watched him for a long moment until her kids ran up to the car, and when she looked back up, it was gone. A few months later, in the summer of 1966, Mary Heyer was driving along the Ohio side of the river when she suddenly saw a glint in the sky she first thought was a plane. But after a closer look, she realized the thing was perfectly round. She said she couldn't figure out what she'd seen, but she didn't give it much thought at the time. Obviously, later she would consider as more things continued to go on in the town, and then obviously the big tragedy happened.
Which one?
The one that we'll talk about later. On the evening of October 7th that same year, an attorney named John Vujnovic was driving toward New Cumberland, West Virginia, when he saw a light hovering near a hillside. He said the light began to come toward his car, and his son was frightened, so he slowed the car down to keep a good distance behind the object. He described it as having an outer, circular light that glowed, but there was no sound. It dipped down at the lowest point to 400 feet in the air, John said, at one time it looked as if there were windows in the craft, and after it got past, we could see a revolving light. The outer glow of the light made a fast flickering type of light as the object was hovering. It eventually disappeared, and he went on his way. His sighting was one of the very first of many important sightings in West Virginia that month. And as the month progressed, there were a ton of sightings all over the state. Lights and some dark objects of enormous size were seen from one end of West Virginia to the other. In Sistersville, local UFO enthusiasts organized a system of calling each other on party lines to announce UFO Northeast, etc., but the town's paper didn't publish a single report, even though it was happening like on a nightly basis. As if on clockwork, every night at approximately 8 p.m., brilliant flashing lights would cruise over the Ohio River, flying over Point Pleasant from north to south. Most that even bothered to notice thought it was an airplane. Mrs. Kelly, who I mentioned earlier at the playground at her children's school, who had seen the long-haired silver surfer in the sky, lived on the edge of a deep gully, and she said that her and her children were seeing bright, blinding globes of light traveling close to the ground along the gully on a nightly basis. It kind of sounds like exactly like those things that Adam said he saw on our listener story episode. Yeah. She said, additionally, Her phone was acting strange, ringing when no one was on the line, and sometimes beeping like Morse code would come from the other end, or it would be Bianca pretending to sing Betty Boop to people over there. Boop, beep, 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 boop.
That's not what I said.
It's like, what?
Listen up.
What Betty Boop are you listening to?
My grandmother calls me Boop. She calls me Boop.
Oh, does she?
Like Betty. Like Aww. Betty Boop.
That's cute.
So
you, it's so weird I know that it. You get it wrong. Yeah.
It's a boop, boop, beep, boop. Boop, boop, bee, doo, doo.
I don't think that's right. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see.
Listen.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Early,
I might be wrong.
Yeah, I think you're wrong. I'm almost positive. Early in November, an elderly man Mary Heyer knew told her he had to tell someone his experience. Although his story seemed entirely out of the realm of possibility, Mary said he seemed entirely sincere about it. His story went a little something like this. On November 2nd, 1966, he said he and another workman were driving home to Point Pleasant from their job near Marietta, Ohio, on Interstate 77. As they neared Parkersburg, West Virginia, an elongated object appeared low in the sky and descended directly in front of them. They stopped their car, and a man emerged from the object and walked over to them. He looked like a normal man and was grinning broadly. He wore a black coat and kept his arms folded with his hands out of sight under his armpits, which is weird. Why is he holding his hands in his armpits like that? The witness rolled his window down and there was a very brief conversation. The stranger asked the pair who they were, where they were from, where they were going, and what time was it. Then he strolled back to the dark cylinder and it rose quickly into the chilly, drizzling sky. The two men had a strong emotional reaction to the seemingly pointless encounter. They debated whether they should tell anybody, deciding against it. But the Point Pleasant resident found himself suffering from insomnia afterward, and when he finally slept, he had strange nightmares. He started to hit the bottle, which is something that was very unusual for him. And as he told his story, Mary took down some notes but did not react or say much. The following day, the man's son called and asked her not to publish anything about his father's story. Weeks later, she told the story to John Keel, and they called the man on the phone. He confirmed the details of the story, but said to them, "Look, don't use my name. I don't want to get involved in this thing. That scientist fella told me," and they interrupted him, "What scientist?" And then he answered, "A couple of weeks ago after this thing happened, a scientist from Ohio came to see us. He told us it would be better if we forgot the whole thing." They asked him how he heard about it and how he found him, and he said, "Damned if I know." They asked if he identified himself, and he said, "Sure, but I can't remember his name," but he seemed to know what he was talking about. This may have sounded a bit far-fetched, save for the fact that the exact same thing happened on the very same night, on the very same road, to yet another West Virginian. But unlike the Point Pleasant resident, this dude went to the police, after which a press conference was held, and the whole situation was catapulted to become one of the biggest UFO stories of 1966. But before we get into that most famous of encounters, the day before it took place, on November 1st, at a National Guard armory on the edge of Point Pleasant, a National Guardsman was working outside when he saw a figure perched high on a limb of a tree beyond the fence. At first, he thought it was a man, but after he studied it a bit, he decided it was the biggest bird he had ever seen in his life. He called some of his friends over to check it out, and when they came, it was obviously gone, because that's what always happens. The following day at 7 p.m. on November 2nd came the big one. Woodrow Derenberger was in his early 50s working as an appliance salesman and living a simple life in a farmhouse in Mineral Wells, West Virginia. He was heading home in his panel truck after a long day on the road. It was a chilly, rainy night, and as he drove along I-77, he heard a crash sound in the back of his truck.
He turned on his interior lights and saw that a sewing machine had fallen off of the top of the stereo that was in the back of his truck, but there didn't seem to be any real damage. A car then swept up behind him and passed him, another vehicle seeming to be following it. He had been slightly speeding, so he slowed up, thinking it might be a police car, and the vehicle cut him off and slowed down even further. Woodrow gasped when he saw what it was. He said it wasn't a vehicle, but it was shaped like an old-fashioned kerosene lamp chimney, flaring at both ends, narrowing down to a small neck, and then enlarging in a great bulge in the center. It was charcoal gray. He slammed on his brakes as the object turned crossways, blocking the road, and stopped only 8 to 10 feet from it.
Then the door slid open and a man stepped out.
Now, what in the world would he be referencing if he was kind of manifesting that UFO in his mind?
What do you mean?
Well, because we're kind of talking about how the shape of what people see as a UFO has changed over time. And then you were talking about how
people see what they know.
Yeah. Like, what in the world? I've never heard of this kind of description of a UFO before. What in the world is a kerosene lamp?
Chimney.
I don't know. Anyway, Woody later said that while he didn't actually hear an audible voice, he just knew that what the man was thinking, and he wanted him to roll the window down. He described the man as being 5'10", with long, dark hair that was combed straight back. He was super tan and, again, grinning broadly.
That grinning broadly thing just...
It's comfortable.
It's unsettling.
Yeah, it's not comforting. With his arms crossed and his hands tucked under his armpit. So this is something that both of these people separately said to each other, or said about their encounters. Which, I mean, why would two people see a man with his hands tucked in his armpits like that? Mm-hmm. The man wore a dark top coat, and underneath, Woody could see that there was some kind of garment that was made from a glistening green material that was almost metallic in appearance. He sensed the man said to him, "Do not be afraid. We mean you no harm. I come from a country much less powerful than yours." And again, there were no audible words, just that huge grin the whole time, which is also kind of like a man, hat man.
Yes.
Which may be part of this too. You know, they may all be the same thing. Who knows? He telepathically asked Woody's name, and he told it to him. The man then introduced himself. "My name is Cold. I sleep, breathe, and bleed, even as you do."
He nodded towards the lights of Parkersburg and telepathically asked what kind of a place it was, to which Woodrow explained that it was a city, a center for businesses and homes. Cold explained to him that such places in his world were called gatherings. While this whole conversation was happening, the chimney-shaped object began hovering about 40 to 50 feet above the road as drivers passed by,
seemingly not even noticing it at all somehow. Then Cold told Woody to report the encounter to the authorities, saying he would come forward at a later date to confirm everything. Then Cold told him he would meet him again soon, and the object descended, the door opened, and he got in. The craft rose quickly and silently into the night.
When he got home, understandably, he was distraught. His wife urged him to call the Parkersburg Police Department, who seemed to accept his story without question, and asked him if he needed a doctor. Meanwhile, if this was a woman, they would have committed her and 100% not believed a word of the story, but all right, cool, go off.
The following day, both city and state police questioned Woody at length, and his story appeared in local TV, radio, and newspaper stories. People who had driven the same route that evening came forward to say that they had in fact seen a man on the side of the highway talking to a man driving a panel truck, as Woody did. Mrs. Frank and her children, yet again, witnessed the same object soar low over the highway minutes after Woody watched it depart. Another man said it had nearly scared the wits out of him when the object hovered over his car and shined a blinding light on him. 2 days later, Woody was riding with a coworker on Route 7 outside of Parkersburg when he began to feel a tingling sensation in his forehead. He says then thoughts from Mr. Cold began to arrive full-blown in his mind. Cold explained he was from the planet Lanalus, which was in the galaxy of Ganymede. Lanalus was very much like Earth, he said, with flora and fauna and seasons, and on his planet he was married to a lady named Kimmy and had two sons. Life expectancy on Lanalus was 125 to 175 years, and naturally there was no war, poverty, hunger, or even misery on Lanalus. He then told Woody to brace himself because withdrawal from the transmission would be painful. Woody said he felt a sharp pain in his temple and he nearly passed out after the transmission was ended with.
So he just contacted him to say, "Hey, just so you know,
this is who I am. Yeah.
Deuces.
Couldn't tell you before." Or maybe he's just pretending like that's what
like
he
that's
is.
What happened.
Or that's Cold is pretending like that's what he is.
Sure.
So that it makes Woody feel more comfortable in talking to him and whatever else, being more open to the possibility of him breaking into his head. Woody became a big time celebrity of sorts. People gathered at his farm every night hoping to catch a glimpse of whatever it was he had seen. He ended up switching his phone number to an unlisted one, but soon began receiving threatening phone calls telling him to shut up, then calls that were nothing more than weird electronic sounds and code-like beeps. It was just Bianca.
Fuck you.
2 weeks after his second transmission of thoughts from Mr. Cold, and though Woody wasn't aware of it at all, two salesmen traveled to Mineral Wells and went from house to house with their wares. At one house, they were selling Bibles, at another, they were selling hardware, and at yet another, they were Mormon missionaries from Salem, Oregon. Side note, there was a big UFO wave hitting mm-hmm. Salem at the time. And one of the men was tall and blonde, and his partner was a short man with an olive complexion and very pointed features. They asked people of the town questions about Woody Derenberger and the validity of his alleged contact with Mr. Cold. And the locals really couldn't get enough of Woody and his story, becoming a rather enormous nuisance to him. They were camping out in his yard, some bringing guns and sitting perched behind trees, waiting to bag themselves a genuine alien. In the midst of all the hustle and bustle, a black Volkswagen drove up, parked, and a tanned man in a crisp black suit got out. He and Woody walked to the edge of the porch and talked for a few minutes before the man got back in the Volkswagen and drove off. According to Woody, he had been suffering from a stomach bug for some time, and that had been good old Mr. Cold who had come to drop off a vial of medicine, which he claimed cured him instantly. He had also provided Woody with a first name. The man's name was Indrid Cold. And all those dummies waiting around in his yard for the dude to show up with a flashing alien sign were none the wiser that evening, as he had showed up and left without them even noticing, because he doesn't look like a green giant beast, I guess. Woody would later voluntarily undergo hours of tests at the suggestion of the NICAP, which is National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, subcommittee, in which the doctor found that there was no evidence of abnormalities at all. There was no evidence of organic brain damage or of seizure disorders. They found a completely normal record with no indication of any central nervous system pathology at all. There was no evidence of mental disorder or lower pathology. Regardless, NICAP would later discredit Woody, denouncing his experience as a hoax and misspelling his name, Indrid Cold's name. A ton of information is wrong in the report, even though Woody had spelled it outright from the very beginning, and that is how it was spelled throughout the subcommittee's documents, so I don't really understand why it would be misspelled at all. That said, Dr. Morgan would later describe an experience that he had himself after examining Woody at the Parkersburg Hospital. He said he was watching football that December when he began to be overcome with a strange sensation as a voice began speaking to him, that it was coming from a spaceship somewhere overhead. Which is a bit, probably much, a bit much, but maybe it's true. At the very same time, Woody had visitors himself, a man that had ID'd himself as Captain Bruce Parsons of NASA Security Police at Cocoa Beach in Florida, who invited him to Cape Kennedy. Shortly after, Woody and his family did go to Cape Kennedy to spend a week with Captain Parsons. They toured the rocket launching installation, and at night, Woody was taken to a room where he was questioned for hours, covering every minute detail of his visits with Indrid Cold. According to Woody, at the end of the week, they showed him a picture of a star map pointing to a speck and telling him that's where they're from. When asked why they didn't release their information to the public, they told him that it would only cause panic. Woody would bring souvenirs back from his trip. Photographs and a scrap of material used in our astronauts' spacesuits that he said was the same kind of reflective material worn by Indrid Cold under his coat that rainy night. So, I mean, he has proof that he was there, supposedly. So I don't know what to think about that. I choose to believe him, obviously. And, I mean, his mental health was
deemed to be fine.
And sure, the doctor that performed those tests also was visited in his head one night, but maybe they all were. Then on November 14th, Newell Partridge, a resident of Salem, West Virginia, had an odd encounter. Around 10:30 that night, the TV suddenly blinked out and a real fine herringbone pattern appeared on it. And at the same time, a loud whining noise began winding up to a high pitch, peaking and breaking off as if it was on a musical scale and went as high as it could and came back down and repeated it. Newell said it sounded like a hand field generator that one might use for portable radio transmission in an emergency. His German Shepherd Bandit ran outside and began howling on the porch toward the direction of the family's hay barn. When Newell shined his flashlight in the direction of the barn, he picked up two red circular eyes, which he described as looking like bicycle reflections. He said that they were difficult to explain, as he was an experienced lifelong hunter and was accustomed to seeing the reflection of many different animal eyes in the night. For one, he said, the eyes were huge. Even at the football field length distance they were seeing them from. The minute he illuminated the eyes with his light, Bandit snarled and ran toward them, and Newell said a cold chill swept over him that prevented him from chasing his dog. That night, he said he slept with a loaded gun beside his bed. The next morning, he went looking for his dog, walking down to the barn where he could see Bandit's paw prints, which were easy to find as it was muddy and the dog was large. At the approximate position that he'd seen the eyes, there was a concentrated amount of dog tracks which went in a circle like the dog had been chasing its tail, even though he'd never seen Bandit chase his tail in his life. Even more odd, there was no other tracks of any kind, and none showing what happened to Bandit after he ran in circles. He just seemed to vanish into thin air. Newell said the hardest thing to explain was the feeling involved in the experience, saying it was an eerie feeling he'd never had before. He said it was as if he knew something was wrong, but he couldn't place just what it was, which we've heard time and time again.
At 11:30 p.m. on November 15th of 1966, two couples from Point Pleasant, Roger and Inga Scarberry, and Steve and Mary Millette, told police they saw a large creature whose eyes glowed red when the car's headlights picked it up, and described the creature as a, quote, large flying man with 10-foot wings. Following their car while they were driving in an area outside of town, the site of the former World War II munitions plant, referred to as the TNT area. Roger, who was 18 at the time, was driving, and they made a circuit of the roads around the igloos and returned to the old generator plant near an unlocked gate. As they pulled up along the plant, Linda gasped. They all looked into the blackness and saw two bright red circles about 2 inches in diameter and 6 inches apart, causing Roger to slam on the brakes. The lights bobbed away from the building, and the two couples saw that they were attached to a huge animal. Roger later said it was shaped like a man but bigger, maybe 6.5 or 7 feet tall, and it had wings folded against its back. Linda said that its eyes were like automobile reflectors. Roger agreed, saying that they were hypnotic. He said, for a minute, we could only stare at it. I couldn't take my eyes off of it.
That is also a big factor in a lot of these different tales, is that the eyes are like have a hypnotic effect on you to where you can't break away.
Well, same with like black-eyed kids.
Yeah.
Like, people are like hypnotized by these kids.
I forgot about that.
The creature was grayish in color, and it walked on sturdy, man-like legs. It then turned slowly and shuffled toward the door of the generator plant, which was ajar and hanging off its hinges. It was then that they fled the scene, shooting through the gates and spinning onto the exit road, heading for Route 62. Then they saw it, or another like it, standing on a small hill near the road. As they sped past it, it spread its bat-like wings and took off straight up into the air. Again, that upward, rent,
like the almost physically impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
Then they sped up, and the creature began following the couples, who, according to Roger, were doing 100 miles per hour on the highway.
Damn.
He said, that bird kept right up with us. It wasn't even flapping its wings.
Damn.
Mary said that she could hear it making a sound, adding that it squeaked like a big mouse.
What?
How cute.
This takes away.
It's so cute.
Yeah, this really takes away some of the fear.
Waddles, squeaks like a mouse.
What do you mean? Maybe she mistook because she was inside of a car.
Maybe.
Like a...
No, I think it sounds like a little mouse.
I mean, maybe a giant moth would sound like a mouse.
Probably, yeah.
Because a moth does not make a sound. So maybe an enormous one...
Yeah, see?
Aw, little guy.
Little guy. Roger said it kept up with them right to the city limits. They went directly to the Mason County Courthouse and told their story to Deputy Millard Halstead. The deputy got into a patrol car and followed the car back, their car, Roger's car, back to the TNT area. Of course, back at the power plant, there was no sign of the creature. He switched on his police radio, and a very loud signal blasted out of the speaker, drowning out the voice of the police dispatcher in Point Pleasant. It was a loud garble, like a record or a tape recording being played at a very high speed.
Oh, weird.
The deputy was taken aback, but said nothing as he looked into the darkness, and he was reluctant to search the building, but he was convinced. The next morning, Sheriff George Johnson called a press conference and local reporters interviewed the four witnesses. Mary Heyer sent the story out on the Associated Press wire, and that evening, the bird was the topic being talked about throughout the Ohio Valley.
Have you heard about that giant bird man?
Oh, that was a really good transatlantic accent. It's a bird. An anonymous copy editor gave it a name spun off from the Batman comic character Killer Moth, who was at the time the subject of a popular TV series. And like I said in the beginning of the episode, they tagged the creature as Mothman.
Mothman. Mary Heyer would later tell John Keel that she had heard Roger and Steve recount their story dozens of times to an inordinate amount of investigators and reporters, and not once had one detail changed or anything more been added to their story. So she found that to be quite believable. And so do I. Hear, hear.
Okay. The next night, on November 16th of 1966, long lines of cars circled the TNT area slowly. Men with guns surrounded the old power plant, looking in every bush, and as there wasn't much to do in the 6,000-person town of Point Pleasant, Mothman was almost a welcome addition.
Well, why do you got your guns, then?
Well,
get your guns gone.
Right. Get them gone.
Get them gone.
Get your guns gone.
Mothman doesn't want to be playing with no guns.
A large red light moved around in the sky directly above the TNT area that night, but few of the monster hunters paid attention to it because that I called him a monster.
No, I'm like, listen up.
Are you
an
idiot?
They're blind as fuck to the real shit going on around them.
Right.
Oh my God.
You got so viscerally angry right now.
I'm just furious because I'm like, y'all, you, first of all, injured cold came up and you guys were like, where's the giant green alien? I'm just waiting for the giant green alien. And then now you've got an enormous light just hovering in the sky. And you're like, where's this Mothman? I'm looking for something with wings. Like, maybe it's showing itself differently right now.
Oh my God,
Ashley. God damn it.
I love your accent. I love when you do your accent. It's so cute.
I'm so mad.
However, Raymond Walmsley, his wife, and Marcella Bennett and her baby daughter, Tina, watched it puzzled. How do we know how Tina watched it, though?
Good question.
Did we interview Tina? Marcella said it wasn't an airplane. We couldn't figure out what it was. They were just about the only people in the crowd who weren't looking for the creature. They were on their way to visit the Thomases, who lived in a bungalow among the igloos. Mr. Thomas was the superintendent of the Trojan U.S. operations there, and his wife, Virginia, had, quote, second sight, which is the capacity to see remote or future objects or events.
A soothsayer.
The end. Yes. Virginia had accurately predicted numerous accidents and local events over the years, but only her friends knew about her abilities because she didn't like to draw attention to herself.
Yeah, otherwise you're going to have every Tom, Dick, and Harry in town coming over and saying, what's the lottery numbers, Virginia?
She was deeply religious and went to church almost every evening.
Oh, get it together, Virginia. Fucking hell.
And on this particular night, she and her husband were out. The Walmsleys and Marcella found only three of the Thomas children. God, only three out of how many? Ricky, Connie, and Vicky at home. And after talking to the kids quickly, probably about, like, something about, like, where are your parents? Can I get a smoke?
Yeah.
One of your smokes, one of you children. They went back to the car, and in the distance, they heard someone fire a rifle around the power plant.
Oh, my God. Henry O'Keefe down there shooting at the air because he saw a branch move.
Suddenly, a figure stirred in the darkness behind their parked car. Marcella said it seemed as if it had been lying down. It rose up slowly from the ground, a big gray thing, bigger than a man with terrible glowing red eyes.
Why was it rising up slowly from the ground either? That's creepy and I don't like it.
Well, she was so terrified that she dropped the baby.
Oh, that's a bad one.
But instead of picking the baby back up, she just stood transfixed.
Oh my gosh.
And hypnotized by the blazing red circles on top of the towering headless creature.
Was the baby okay?
Yeah, the baby was fine.
All right.
Its giant wings unfolded slowly behind its back, and Raymond grabbed her and the child, and they all ran back to the house and bolted the door shut.
It would have been kind of funny if they ran away and left the baby laying there, just because.
Just slightly. Because she dropped it.
Yeah, because she dropped it.
There was a sound on the porch, and the two red eyes peered in through a window.
I'm just saying, she doesn't have maternal instincts.
Yeah, no, to drop your baby.
I'm scared. Just throw your hands in the air. Oh, no.
The women and children became hysterical, and Raymond frantically called the police since they were less than a mile away and armed to the teeth. But by the time the police arrived, the creature was gone.
Same old story.
During the next few days, other people reported similar sightings. Two volunteer firemen who saw it said it was a large bird with red eyes. Mason County Sheriff George Johnson commented that he believed the sightings were due to an unusually large heron.
Oh.
He termed a shite poke.
A shite poke.
Contractor Newell Partridge told Johnson that when he aimed a flashlight at a creature in a nearby field, its eyes glowed like bicycle reflectors, and blamed buzzing noises from his television set and the disappearance of his German Shepherd dog on the creature.
Newell, we talked about you, and I feel bad about your dog. But I feel like his dog was like the second, it wasn't the first thing that annoyed him. He's like, my dog's gone, yes, but there was a noise I was hearing every night from my TV.
Also, TV, yeah, exactly. Wildlife biologist Robert Smith at West Virginia University told reporters that descriptions and sightings all fit the sandhill crane, a large American crane almost as high as a man with a 7-foot wingspan, featuring circles of reddish coloring around the eyes, and that the bird may have wandered out of its migration route. This particular crane was unrecognized at first because it was not native to this region.
Listen.
But I don't think so.
Sometimes you're trying to make a logical sense of the situation is more illogical than a giant Mothman.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
It's like, no. I saw a man with wings that look like a bat. I don't think I'm confusing it with a fucking crane,
right.
But thank you.
Right.
Because it has red around its eyes and that somehow makes it glow in the dark. At 4:45 a.m. on November 17th, across the Ohio River, music teacher Mrs. Gross was awoken by the barking of her dog, which was very unusual that early in the morning. So she got up to investigate. The moon was very bright that evening, and as she looked out her window to check on what the dog was making the racket about, she saw a huge object hovering above the treetops in a field on the other side of Route 7, which is an area that should sound familiar. She described it as the size of a house, circular in shape, and illuminated brilliantly. It seemed to her that it was divided into sections that glowed with dazzling bright red and green lights. She said she was stunned, and before she could wake her husband, the craft made a zigzag motion and disappeared, which is also a similar movement pattern to UFO sightings, is a zigzag pattern. She didn't mention the sighting to anyone outside of her family for weeks. But that very same afternoon that she saw the object, a 17-year-old boy was driving down Route 7, not too far from Mrs. Gross's house in Cheshire, Ohio, when he said a huge bird dove at his car and pursued him for around 1 mile. There were sightings all over the state in 5 different counties. People were driving from all over to sit in the TNT area, waiting to catch the creature. Anytime anyone did see it, they swore they never wanted to see it again, said the experience was so terrifying and invoked fears so deep within themselves they never wanted to encounter it again. Much like stories of UFOs, the creature seemed to take pleasure in chasing cars, along with scaring females who were menstruating, which coincidentally is a similarity to stories of UFO and Squatch encounters, as we'll get into sometime this year. Which I did find funny as well. I'm like, oh God, get away from me now. I'm in a bad spot. Leave me alone. Then on the evening of November 20th, well, wait, let me go back to that because the blood thing is like very weird.
Yeah, it's strange.
And something that I didn't really talk about too much, but in this very same situation this year of all this stuff going on, there were animal mutilations, just like at Skinwalker Ranch, that were like surgical precision mm-hmm. of dogs and cattle and maybe some other farm animals. But they were surgically cut up somehow. Mm-hmm. No blood was anywhere, just like with Skinwalker Ranch. What the fuck is that? And why are they obsessed with blood? And then there's like right. women are menstruating and they're like, woo! But then that's also something that happens with UFO and Squatch encounters? Like, what is... That's because they're all the same thing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But also, why? Why? What is that?
What is that?
And why is there no... Yeah.
Why?
What's the blood thing?
I don't know. Why menstruating women?
You know, I think we kind of postulated about it a little, that it might have something to do with our reproductive situation, mm-hmm. because a lot of the time those organs are removed in cattle
yes,
and stuff.
Yes.
Again, who knows, but it's just so weird. Like, what do they want? Menstrual blood so they can like figure out. I have no fucking idea. I have no idea. Maybe they have advanced technology that they're able to create humans just from a bit of menstrual blood stem cell. I don't know what the fuck. Okay. Then on the evening of November 20th, five teens driving along Campbell's Creek saw a bird-like creature the size of a man standing beside a rock quarry that turned and ran into the woods when they came near. One of the teens, Brenda Jones, said, "Nobody believes us because we're teenagers, but it was real scary." An elderly businessman living in Point Pleasant went to see what his dog was barking at one morning and came face to face with a 7-foot-tall gray apparition with what he described as flaming eyes. The man stood completely transfixed for several minutes until the creature flew away and the man made his way back inside, where he was in such a state that his wife thought he was having a heart attack. On November 24th, two adults and two children were driving past the TNT area when they all witnessed a giant flying creature with red eyes. People were splitting time between that spot and Woody Derenberger's farm, waiting for a peek at the Mothman, but it seemed like the old Mothman had a plan, and when he would make unexpected appearances in front of people that had previously been incredibly skeptical of the situation altogether. So it was like he was trying to convince people of his existence for some reason. At 7:15 a.m. on November 25th, a shoe salesman named Thomas Urey was driving on Route 62 north of the TNT area when he saw a tall, gray, man-like figure standing in a field by the road. He said it suddenly spread a pair of wings that spanned every bit of 10 feet and took off straight up like a helicopter. He said he was terrified, put the pedal to the metal, and was going about 75 miles an hour, and the creature continued to do circles over his car, 3 telephone poles high, keeping up with him the whole time. So not only was he going 75 miles an hour and it was keeping up with him, it was also doing circles over his car at the same time. So I'm not sure how in the world it's able to do such a thing. Thomas said he was so scared he couldn't go to work that day and drove straight to the sheriff's office. That oft-mentioned feeling of unreasonable terror had taken hold of him. He said, "I've never had that feeling before, a weird kind of fear. That fear gripped you and held you. Somehow, the best way to explain it would be to say that the whole thing just wasn't right. I know that may not make sense, but that's the only way I can put it into words what I felt." Which is something that we hear, again, time and time again, with all sorts of stories from black-eyed children to shadow people to anything.
Everything. Just doesn't feel right.
That same week, a hunter in Pennsylvania said he saw a 7-foot-tall gray bird darting in and out of trees, saying his dog ran after it, but then let out a howl and ran back to him with his tail between his legs, whimpering. Aww. On November 26th, in Lowell, Ohio, which was about 70 miles north of Point Pleasant, the Shock family watched a group of giant birds for around 2 hours. They said they looked as big as a man would look, moving around in the trees, and when they attempted to move closer to the animals, they flew off. They described them as being 4 to 5 feet tall, had wingspans of at least 10 feet, and gave off a reddish cast with 5 to 6 inch straight bills, though they did not see the glowing eyes of many of the other reports. Over 1966 to 1967, over 100 adults would witness this giant bird, all agreeing on the general features, but never able to describe its face. On that same day, November 26th, a Mrs. Ruth Foster of Charleston, West Virginia, said she found Mothman on her front lawn beside the porch. She said it was tall with big red eyes that popped out of its face and was around the same height as her husband, who was 6'1". She said it had a funny little face, no beak, just mainly the big red bulging eyes. She said she screamed and ran back into the house, and when her brother-in-law ran out to look for it, it was gone. Now let us go back to Connie Carpenter and John Keel, who we talked about earlier. So this is Mary Hires, the town newspaper reporter and just general, I don't want to say busybody, but like busybody in the best of ways. Her niece, who had the experience and her eyes were swollen shut. So what he had found odd in her case was that she hadn't seen a super bright light emanating from a flying saucer. What Connie saw that night that caused her eyes to nearly swell shut was a giant winged man in the middle of a sunny morning. which, you know, that's another thing is I'm sure people are like, well, it's in the middle of the night. You're just seeing something in the dark and you're telling yourself it's a giant Mothman. But this was in the middle of the morning. She was driving home from church at 10:30 a.m. on Sunday, November 27th, when she passed the deserted Mason County Golf Course. She suddenly saw an enormous gray figure that was shaped like a man, but much larger, over 7 feet tall and very broad. So that's another thing. Everybody says it's gray for some reason, like just, but more than its size, she said she was transfixed by its large, round, fiercely glowing red eyes that seemed to focus on her with a hypnotic effect. She described the creature's face as science fiction-like, but that the eyes were the standout feature.
Science fiction-like?
I don't know. I think it's just difficult for anyone to explain what the face looks like for some reason. Connie slowed her car, and as she did, a pair of wings unfolded from the back of the creature. She guessed they spanned 10 feet. She said the man-bird creature slowly rose off the ground, straight up, like a helicopter, completely silent. Its wings did not flap in flight, so I almost wonder, like, why in the hell does it even have them then, if it doesn't even flap them to fly? Yeah. It's almost just for looks or something. She said it's headed straight toward her, eyes still focused directly on her, and then swooped low over her head. She slammed her foot down on the gas pedal and got the fuck out of there as fast as she could. Over 100 people, like I said, would see the same creature around this time, and Connie's conjunctivitis would last more than 2 weeks from just looking at this glowing red eyes, perhaps, in the middle of the day. It's just so odd to me that that would cause such a terrible eye burn. Connie would later be visited by the man who called himself Jack Brown. Connie, her husband Keith, and brother Larry were all there the night Jack Brown showed up at their door. So they noticed his awkward mannerisms, his dark hypnotic eyes, and how he wouldn't speak if anyone was looking directly into them. He asked them questions about her Aunt Mary and her relationship with Keel. He asked Connie what Mary would say if someone told her to stop talking and writing about UFOs. They all noticed his unusually long fingers and that there was something incredibly off about him, his ears especially. Something about the man was just not quite right. The same day that Connie had her experience, Sheila Kane, a 13-year-old in St. Albans, and her younger sister were walking home from the store when they saw what they described as an enormous something.
Oh. Well, at least they were descriptive.
That's what I'm looking for in life. That was at least 7 feet tall, gray and white, with big red eyes, that was standing beside a local junkyard. The girls screamed and ran home, and they said it flew in the air and followed them part of the way. So the Air Force obviously wasn't willing to admit that there was anything amiss going on here and had a general line that they fed to the public about weather balloons or some other nonsense explanation. And it was the same old song and dance when John Keel went to them to discuss his experiences and his investigation and countless interviews that he'd done with people who had witnessed something. But later, an investigator and science writer named Lloyd Mallion gained access to the UFO records that were stored at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, which we talked about in Project Blue Book episode.
And I went to tech school at
56. Oh, and that too. And this was their headquarters. Considering Blue Book was a disinformation campaign, the records weren't exactly in order, complete, and in some cases, they weren't even there at all.
Man, you know, in retrospect, I should have explored Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as much as I could.
Well, how did you know
at the time? But how would I know at the time? Yeah, I wasn't into this at the time.
Yeah. And you were not really there to
do that fuck around either. Yeah. That's true.
You know. But it was a bit of a stretch to believe that these mysterious men and women visitors were an arm of this disorganized and frankly lackluster crew because they didn't really have much of an objective. And I don't think they would be putting all this effort into trying to get people to stop talking. Furthermore, considering that Project Blue Book was officially ended at the end of 1969 and Men in Black have been seen since, it is unlikely that the Men in Black that we are talking about are truly government agents, even though I do think that they're trying to pretend to be government agents. In some way, for some reason. I guess just maybe for an intimidation factor. While Mothman and Indrid Cold were captivating everyone's attention in the skies at night, familiar dark visitors began arriving in West Virginia. A doctor and his wife were driving along a country road in a snowstorm when they saw a huge caped figure of a man struggling through the snow. They stopped to give him a ride, and he had completely vanished in a whirlwind of snowflakes, they said.
Yikes.
Black limos stopped in front of the homes on the hill, and deeply tanned census takers. If that doesn't that sounds familiar if you listen to our Men in Black episode, because they're pretending to be census takers for some reason, inquired about the number of kids living with families, and in many cases, they simply asked for a glass of water. A blonde woman in her 30s with a southern accent visited people in West Virginia and Ohio and introduced herself as John Keel's secretary. She was not. I don't know what they were out doing, but I'm assuming they were just trying to get a feel for, like,
the area,
the people that lived there, what was going on with them and their families, and they were asking questions about John Keel a lot, too. In January, the Christensens, who had a UFO encounter back in November, were living in a new house, unlisted address, unlisted phone number, in a fairly isolated spot, when they were visited by a strange man one evening who said he was there because Edward Christensen was the possible inheritor of a great sum of money, which is going to let anybody be like, yeah. Whoa, well, come in then. Right. Let me give you a little talking to. They said he was well over 6'5", and like many other accounts, had protruding eyes. They described him as having an unnatural pallor, assuming he was sick. But come right in, because you might be giving me money. He spoke with a strange, high, tinny voice, which sounds like a nightmare, that seemed especially peculiar coming from such a large man. And yeah, I think that's pretty unlikely, because I was trying to think about it, and is there like any giant man in in the world, in that history, has tiny, that has a tinny voice?
No.
It seems unlikely. They said he spoke in a dull, emotionless monotone in clipped words and phrases like he was a computer. Connie said it sounded like he was reciting everything from memory. He wore a gold or brass badge with a big K and a small X on it, but for some reason he seemed to not want to let them see it. Like, he took his jacket off, and when his badge showed, he like quickly covered it up with his hand for some reason. I'm like, why would you even be wearing it then?
Yeah, don't take it off in the car.
The soles of his shoes, they said, were unusually thick rubber, which is also something that a few other people who encountered these suspicious Men in Black people, that they have unusually thick rubber soles on their shoes for some reason.
That's a pretty common thing.
But what they were most fascinated by was a thick green wire attached to the inside of his leg. It came out of his socks and disappeared under his trousers. They said at one point it seemed indented into his leg, and it was covered by a large brown spot. I don't really know what the heck that is. They were trying to decide if he was like remotely controlled or something.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. But I think we actually talked about that story in Men in Black episode, honestly. I have a vague recollection.
I don't.
When the family dog Gigi snarled and barked at the man, he spoke to the dog and she was immediately calmed, which I found interesting.
Weird.
Yeah, because one, that usually won't happen with a stranger, but who knows? It depends on the dog.
Right.
But also, I thought it was interesting because a lot of the times people wouldn't speak to animals like that. Anyway, it seemed like he had a calming effect on the dog. When Mrs. Christensen told him that they were about to eat and asked him if he wanted to join, he told her he was on a diet but would like a glass of water in 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
He seemed to...
Well, I know that when I'm thirsty, I'm like, I'm about to be thirsty.
10 minutes from now.
I should, yeah.
What the fuck? Can you give me a nice big sandwich and... 9 minutes and 32 seconds, please. I feel like in that time, I'm going to want one.
Yeah.
He seemed to wheeze like he had asthma, and they all agreed that it appeared he had difficulty breathing. Almost like he isn't from here or something. He pulled out a pen and a pad and began to ask questions about Ed's scars and birthmarks. He wanted every detail, length, width, exact location, all the schools he'd attended, if the couple would be willing to fly any place in the United States to collect inheritance. They said as he talked, his face grew redder and redder, and after a few minutes, he asked if he could have that glass of water now. He took out a large yellow capsule and gulped it down, returning to normal immediately after taking it. During 1966 to 1967, throughout the Ohio River Valley, dogs, horses, and cattle were dying from typically, here I am, getting ahead of myself, surgical-like incisions in their throats, and just like in the Uinta Basin region and Skinwalker Ranch, the absence of blood surrounding these animals' deaths truly defies logic. On March 5th, 1967, a Red Cross bloodmobile was traveling along Route 2, which runs parallel to the Ohio River. A Red Cross worker and a nurse had been out all day collecting human blood and were headed back to Huntington, West Virginia, with a van filled with the fresh blood. It was dark and cold, and there was little traffic, and as they moved along a deserted stretch of the highway, there was a flash in the woods up on a hill ahead, and a large white glow appeared. It rose into the air and flew straight towards their vehicle. They floored the gas, and the object effortlessly stayed with the van, hovering above it. They watched in horror as an arm or an extension was being lowered from the ball of light on either side of their van, like it was trying to wrap pinchers around it, or like, what are those little machines with the toys, is essentially what they described it as.
The machines with the toys?
Where you have like the claw and you grab the toys or whatever. That's essentially what they were trying to describe. When they came to a point in the road where more cars were nearing them, the thing retracted the arms and flew off.
Interesting.
They don't know what exactly was going on there, but they were thinking that it may have something to do with the amount of blood that they had on them. Who knows? People all along the Ohio River Valley were seeing lights, creatures, and all kinds of things like that nightly. So I think we talked about Miss Virginia Thomas, but if not, here's another Miss Virginia that was working in her kitchen deep within the TNT area when she heard a loud squeaking, unlike anything she'd ever heard before. She went outside and saw a huge shadow spreading across the grass, and being that it was just after noon, there shouldn't have been any shadows like that going around.
Mm-mm.
Then a figure appeared, walking erect like a man, but all gray, and much bigger than any man that she had ever seen. But maybe she just needed to see the right man. It moved it moved fast across the field and disappeared into the trees. It wasn't walking, she said, but was almost gliding. Faster than any man could run. And that is also something that we've heard before. The gliding thing, and I don't like that at all. Shortly after, Virginia told John Keel of a dream that she'd had of strange people coming around the river, almost like an invasion. Then she later had a terrible nightmare she described where there were tons of people drowning in the river, and Christmas packages were floating everywhere in the water. She said that there were so many people that she felt uneasy ever since having that dream. And she said everybody in Point Pleasant was feeling this uneasiness. Mm. It wasn't something that you could put your finger on, but it seemed like everyone felt it. Something awful was about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The Silver Bridge was constructed in 1928, and at the time, it was regarded as an engineering marvel. It became a main artery from West Virginia to Ohio, but it had not been built for the traffic of the 1960s. Large trucks and tons of people crossed the bridge on a daily basis, as the next nearest bridge was nearly 50 miles upriver. It was 5 p.m. on December 15th, and a stoplight at the mouth of the bridge was malfunctioning, backing up traffic in both directions. A few of the people sitting in the cars backed up on the bridge noted that it was particularly bouncy that day, but it was always shaking. Traffic worsened and pretty much ground to a halt. At 5:04, the whole bridge convulsed. Steel began loudly grinding, and the 700-foot suspension bridge began to twist while the main span split from its moorings at either end. Electric cables that had been strung across the bridge suddenly snapped in a blaze of sparks, and 50 vehicles crashed into the black waters of the Ohio River as tons of steel smashed down on top of them. What a nightmare. 2 miles north of the bridge, Miss Jackie Lilly was in her home when her son pointed out a flashing red light disappearing over the trees behind their home. A few minutes later, a second light appeared. Glaringly bright prismatic lights. Over the next hour, they saw 12 of them hovering just above the treetops and then moving toward the town. So I don't know what those had to do with the river, with the bridge collapse, but there's definitely something weird that this woman watched 12 different prismatic bright lights hovering and then moving towards the town.
I mean, the whole thing is, everything is, has always been said that it's an omen. It was probably an omen of disaster, and that's it, the end.
No. After a month of brutally difficult rescue work, 38 bodies were recovered from the bridge wreckage, while many others were never heard from again and were assumed to have gone down with the bridge as well.
In the end, the collapse of the Silver Bridge brought the death of 46 people, and the incident gave rise to the legend and connected the Mothman sightings to the bridge collapse.
And I mean, I would have to say, so John Keel had this premonition of sorts that something was going to happen. He thought it was going to be like this massive blackout. This woman had that dream. I mean, I do, and I'm not saying, I mean, she could have just said it, but she did say that she had this dream before the bridge collapsed because everybody was just feeling this like incredibly oppressive, ominous energy going on. And I mean, I have to think it's almost, we'll talk about it. I'm like, are they manifesting this? So then on Friday, December 22nd, Mary Heyer was working tirelessly to update the list of missing and known dead as clusters of workmen, police, and various officials continued to drag bloated bodies out of the Ohio River. Various reporters, rescue workers, and family of missing had visited her for information on the town and tragedy. Part of her job entailed keeping record of all the births, marriages, and deaths in the town, and the bridge collapse had made her the woman to get info from in Point Pleasant. On this afternoon, however, she was visited by two men in black overcoats with slightly dark complexions. "We hear that there's been a lot of flying saucer activity around here," one of them said. The comment took Mary aback, as she was shocked anyone was coming to her about anything other than the bridge collapse, which had been the main focus of everyone for the entire week prior, and understandably so, as they were still pulling bodies out of the river. But she told them that they had had a considerable amount of sightings in Point Pleasant, retrieving a large file folder filled with various accounts of sightings and handing it to the man. The man flipped it open, giving it a cursory glance, and then handed it back to her. He asked if anyone had told her not to publish the reports, to which she told him no, and put the folder back in the drawer. "What would you do if someone did order you to stop writing about flying saucers?" he asked. "I'd tell them to go to hell," she responded, which made her a woman after my own heart. And it was at this time that the man looked at each other, and before she even realized that it had happened, they were gone. I don't understand this, because this is not the multiple people asked her or others what she would do if someone told her to stop writing about UFOs. What is that? So weird. Later that afternoon, another strange visitor arrived at Mary's, and this time it was a slight young man, about 5'7", with piercing black eyes, unruly black hair, and unusually long fingers. He introduced himself as Jack Brown and told her that he was a UFO researcher. Mary said the man attempted to have a painfully unsuccessful and awkward discussion about UFOs, then suddenly burst on with, "What would you do if someone ordered you to stop printing UFO stories?"
Like I told the people before.
This obviously made her curious if the guy was with the two weirdos from earlier in the day. He told her no, he was alone, and he was a friend of well-known UFO investigator Gray Barker.
Why do they always say that they're friends of these people?
Like, I don't know. I guess it's like they're trying to make you feel comfortable with them. But it's like, I can just go talk to this guy and ask him in a couple minutes. And he's going to tell me that you're asking creepy questions. And you might have just morphed into some other dude to make yourself look like you're not the same guy who came to me earlier. Right.
The story of the tiny pilot we talked about earlier was revived in 1972, and in 1973, a man identifying himself as Frank Kelly of Corpus Christi arrived in Aurora saying he was a treasure hunter with a ton of experience.
a ton of experience treasure hunting. He's really just talking about getting that sweet, 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 sweet strange.
Sweet, sweet.
That's
sweet,
a treasure. Sweet. That's a kind of treasure hunting. That's the only kind of treasure hunting that there is in the world anymore. Okay.
He announced that he found some metal fragments near the windmill site. He kept some of the pieces and turned the rest over to a reporter named Bill Case. Analysis showed that the pieces were 98% aluminum. His alleged discovery created a stampede of ufologists to Aurora, and investigators descended from as far away as Illinois and battled for permission to dig up graves in the cemetery.
No, no. Who is this? Who is the ones that were digging up? Who was the religious figure that was like digging up graves and stealing? Okay, whatever.
It's Ed Gein.
No, it was like the Mormon. What's the start of Mormonism?
The starter.
We just talked about it.
Joseph Smith.
Yeah, like Joseph Smith, one of those head Mormon guys, was robbing graves, and that was his job.
I love that you went that way and I went the other way. Okay. The story received nationwide renown in the national press in the summer of 1973.
Efforts were then made to find Frank Kelly in Corpus Christi, and it was found that he had given a phony address and phone number, and that no one in treasure hunting had ever heard of him.
There's a big treasure hunting community out there.
You know.
Are you talking about people who are in search of that sweet, sweet strange? I'm a treasure hunter.
He was apparently another one of the impressive but elusive hoaxers who haunt the UFO field. Therefore, the joke was pointless, expensive, and sadly, extremely successful. So, these winged beings are closely associated with luminous phenomena and tend to appear in areas where UFOs have been active. Like UFOs, they also tend to linger for days or even weeks in the same specific area. And I say like UFOs, maybe they're the same thing, maybe they aren't, but they do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In many instances, the witnesses have clearly seen the objects in the process of materialization or dematerialization, wherein a glow is usually seen at first, usually reddish, which marks the emergence of the object from the invisible band of the spectrum into infrared and then into the narrow band of visible light. Or if the object is passing through the visible band into higher frequencies, it's a cyan light color like blue or green before it fades into blue, which is hard to see at night, and then enters the ultraviolet range. Phenomena including with men in black, black-eyed kids, these experiences and so forth are also typically accompanied by chills. It's believed that this is probably caused by microwaves, which produce heat above the infrared, just as the very cold atmosphere accompanying them causes a radiation effect, although the overpowering odor situation like sulfur or sickly sweet fragrances is still unknown. Additionally, camera malfunctions are extremely common with UFO encrypted phenomena like Skinwalker Ranch, Bigfoot, Loch Ness, and it seems as if some outside force causes these malfunctions whenever cryptids and UFOs are around.
For sure. And ghosties.
Ghosty boys.
Mental telepathy is a tested and verified phenomenon. 10% of the population has the ability to see beyond the spectrum of visible light, some having the ability to see radiation and things that are invisible to most of us. John Keel says this explains a great deal of UFO experiences. The things that are typical for them to see are beyond our realm of understanding and thus beyond our belief. This can also possibly explain those who have encounters with the paranormal of all kinds, seeing on a spectrum that most of us typically cannot. But let me tell you right now, 2021 is the year of me developing my skills in that area, everybody. I've already acquired some books on the subject.
Oh, really?
I have. Tibetans believe in the ability of advanced human minds to manipulate invisible energies into physical manifestations called tulpas, like you talked about a little bit earlier. This idea of the tulpa has been adapted by 20th century theosophists that real, tangible things can be manifested through spiritual or mental powers. And I'm not necessarily opposed to that thought. So that said, there is a possibility that a great, you know, interest in whatever science fiction or the possibility of aliens or extraterrestrials may have created a area-wide collective thought that may be manifested into real life creatures is what we're proposing here. As we have and will continue to discuss ad nauseum for the rest of our lives, as we continue to flesh out our ideas and gain more knowledge on the esoteric topics that we cover, the more I learn, the more I believe that the paranormal, the esoteric, all the things that fall under that umbrella are absolutely interconnected. As John Keel continued to investigate the various phenomena throughout his life, he began to think that the UFO phenomena was just one tiny part of a much larger phenomenon. Instead of thinking in terms of extraterrestrials, he began to think of them as ultra-terrestrials, beings and forces that coexist with us but are on another time frame, operating outside the limits of our space-time continuum, but have the ability to cross over into our reality. Instead of simply being strangers from a strange land, he believes that they are and have been observing complex forces which have always been an essential part of our immediate environment. If you've been listening to the show, this should sound somewhat familiar. This other world, he believed, was not a place, but rather a state of energy. Now, if that blows your mind a little to conceptualize, you're not alone, but let's just keep diving in a little further. So So Kiel postulated that these beings are not real in the sense that an airplane is real, for example. He believed that they were transmogrifications of energy, which were under the control of an unknown extra-dimensional intelligence that controls important events by manipulating specific humans through the phenomenon of mystical illumination. And what we know as religion is based upon our longtime awareness of this intelligence and our struggle to make it palatable to our human minds. Mm. The Egyptians, along with the indigenous people of South America, worshipped gods that traveled the night skies in luminous disks of light. Greeks and Roman gods were perched on mountaintops. As time progressed, so did the things we are perceiving as UFOs. The ancient Chinese marked the route of the lights in the sky and called them dragon tracks because dragons allegedly appeared along with these lights. At a later time, these were thought to be fairy lights, which were associated with stories of little people that plagued North American indigenous people along with whole generations in Europe. Vampire legend of Europe is incredibly similar to modern UFO lore, and I'd say it's debatable when the last people actually thought that the old devil was a physical person, as it's quite likely that there are people listening to this right now that believe that that is a physical person. And I gotta say, when you start thinking about, and we've talked about this with Men in Black, but when you start talking about vampires and you start talking about devils and the devil being a person, an actual mm-hmm. person, this Men in Black, this man, this like these, all this lore that all kind of is like goes hand in hand with each other could very well have just slowly shifted into something that makes more sense to modern times.
Right.
You know, it's almost as if someone out there doesn't want us to really understand the true nature and purpose of this phenomenon. Regardless, these mysterious creatures, lights, and phenomena were here long before us and will most assuredly be here long after we're gone. Whether we have a whole new society that's seeing it as something completely different because they have completely different frames of reference. Basically, what John Keel was saying was that they're like part of the earth mm-hmm. and we are just what changes around them. And so they're just figuring out what we need to glean from our encounters with them. And they're just producing experiences that we can handle, but we still have no idea what they're doing it for, I guess. And I mean, he could be wrong, but who knows?
It's their universe and we're just living in it.
Yeah.
We're just passersby.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean,
they all, like I said, all these things have been around since the dawn of time. So mm-hmm. why is that?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And what is it? Who is out there? I need to know. I'll never stop.
All right, y'all. Go follow. Wow, that was a smack for the ages. Go follow us on all the social medias. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and now TikTok. Although we're trying to think of what even to post there.
Yeah.
And our handle for all of them is Creep It Real Pod. If you would like to make a donation to the show, head on over to patreon.com/creepitrealpod. We do extra episodes, just like banter episodes where we just kind of talk about our weeks and
it's a way to get to know us.
It's a better
way
to get
more personal way.
And you know what? The other thing is we did a focus on the family a couple weeks ago and nobody else wanted us to focus on them.
Oh yes, they do. We haven't gotten that. Yeah. If you're in part of the
yes, they do.
If you're part of the family, all, you know, nearly 60 of you, somebody out there in our family,
we
want
to focus on you.
Yeah. So come let us know and we'll put you on the show.
Oh,
we want to sit down and talk to you. It's fun. We had a great time with Jordan.
Yeah, we did.
We've had a great time with Phil. That's the only two people who have done it so far.
Cody. Cody was on the show. And
no, that doesn't count. Doesn't count. He wasn't as focused on the family.
True.
We want to focus on our family. So come on, everybody. And if you are not part of the family yet, but you're like, hey, I want to talk to these girls for 45 minutes, then join the family. Go over to Patreon, join the family, and tell us, like, let me on Focus on the Family. Who wants to be in Focus on the Family?
So head on over to patreon.com/creepitrealpod, or you can go to our website, creepitrealpod.com, and all of the links to everything are there. We are trying to come up with some more gifts for you all, for our patrons, and we are really humbled and really grateful to everyone who does make a contribution. And with your help, we're slowly getting to the point where we can start looking for affiliates and start really thinking about making shows for you for like as a full-time, more consistent endeavor. So from the bottom of our hearts, we really genuinely thank you. Tons and tons and tons.
All right. Have a great life.
Have a great everything.
Creep it real.